Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Meghnad Desai. I used to work here till they finally got fed up of me. So I only get taken out of the box occasionally. But here I was a great occasion to chair the first of our series of chancellors. As you know, there are five lectures. The next one is on 9th of November, where Jeffrey Ha will speak. But today we have Dennis Healy, Lord Healy Riddleston. And I mean, there's so many things I would like to say about him, but you surely want to listen to him and not to me. Almost everything he said about economics in his fabulous autobiography, Time of My Life, is unprintable, although it is printed, and I would advise you not to read it if you want a career in economics. You'd lose all faith. I think because he's here, I would just say one thing that he quotes. Lyndon Johnson said about to Galbraith about doing economics, and he said, and I hope I don't offend anybody by saying this, is that, you know, doing economics is like pissing down your leg. You may feel hot about it, but nobody else is impressed. I cannot register one more quotation from. Again, from the book, and he said that there's a quotation from a Auden poem at the start of this chapter, and clearly quoting from that, what we have this evening is not the tragic hero or the Platonic saint, but to quote, rising triumphant from a lake on a dolphin naked, protected by an umbrella of cherubs. Dennis Healy.
Well, my lord, ladies, gentlemen, and decent people. Yes, there are some here, I'm sure, still, if you haven't taken your degrees. Well, it's an enormous pleasure for me to talk to you, not least because it's the first time for years I haven't had to speak about Iraq. But I look forward very much to talking about my time in the Treasury. It was a difficult time in many ways. I'd spent 6 years as head of the Defence Ministry from 64 to 70, and I found that enormously enjoyable because I travelled all over the world, from Japan to Hawaii and through Africa, Asia, and so on. And I liked the people I met, and I went to places I could never have gone to under other circumstances, like the jungles of Borneo and the Hadramaut in the sunken valley south of the desert of Saudi Arabia. But it was very different and very similar in many ways when I went to the Treasury. There was less travel, and when I did travel, it was mainly to meetings of the IMF in Europe or the United States. The only interesting place I ever went to that I wouldn't otherwise have gone to was Mexico, where we had one meeting, which was enormous fun. And I was interested to find that the Bank of Mexico had to use aircraft to move its gold around the country, because if it tried to send it by road, it would certainly be captured by bandits. I found it was similar in some ways, because when at Defence I had, besides the Central Department, I had three services, the Army, Navy and Air Force, of course, and it was rather the same at the Treasury, because besides my own department, I had to deal with the Bank of England, the Inland Revenue and the Customs and Excise, which were for practical purposes independent. And the people I met were not, on the whole, as interesting and attractive as the people I met when I was at Defence, but some of them became friends for life, like Gordon Richardson, who was head of the Bank of England in my time, and Nick Monk, who was my private secretary, who I was delighted to meet tonight. I think he's somewhere here in the audience. And it was similar in some ways to Defence. The most difficult thing, I think, was in Defence, any decision you took was implemented by people you controlled, wherever they were, Borneo, Aden, anywhere. In the Treasury, of course, the decisions you take are implemented by people you have absolutely no control over whatever. Employers and workers all over the country, and of course consumers, not only all over your own country, but all over the world, people to whom Britain was exporting or from whom she was importing. And so the control of a situation in the Treasury is infinitely more different and more difficult than it was in Defence. But as I say, I liked the people I worked with. There were, some of them were a little bit grey, I suppose is the word. There was one official of whom it was said that he never saw a joke except by appointment. You probably remember who that was, Sam. And the Bank of England was in terrible trouble when I took over, because you'd had the explosion of credit in 1974 and the crisis of the secondary banking system, and it had this very difficult job of trying to protect the value of sterling simply by raising or lowering interest rates. And its job was often described as to exude confidence without actually lying, and to take away the punch bowl just as the party was getting merry. So it was not really a very enjoyable job to have. But Gordon Richardson, who took over just about the same time as I took over the Treasury, was an extraordinarily able and attractive man. To look at him, very smart, with fair hair, you'd think he was a public school boy, but in fact he came from Nottingham High School, like almost everybody who was any good in my time did. Douglas Voss came from Nottingham High School, and so of course in more recent times did Ken Clark, who I'm delighted to see is going to talk to you before long. Gordon himself was an extraordinarily intelligent man with wide interests outside banking and the economy, and he was married to a very attractive woman called Peggy, who was a daughter of Dick Shepherd, who was very famous in those days, who had a tremendous impact on many aspects of society when she was a girl. And we had a relationship which I think is the best one between a Chancellor and the head of the Bank of England, one of creative tension, I describe it. His job is narrower than yours, but he's got to understand all the problems you have to deal with as well as you do, and you have to try to understand his problems as well as he does, but of course it's very difficult for you to do that. He also had some very good deputies. One was a rather forbidding man in a way, big man called Jasper Holland. When I asked him whether it would be wise for me to introduce monetary targets, he replied, well, you'd be simply redesigning your cross. And of course he was absolutely right in that. And the other deputy I saw a great deal of was Kit McMahon, who was an extremely attractive man with great interests outside economics and banking. And like me, he had a passion for good American thrillers, the Black Mask type. And every time he came back from a visit to the United States, he used to bring me the latest novel of George V. Higgins. If you haven't read him, I strongly advise you to do so, because oddly enough, he understood politics almost as well as he understood crime, but perhaps they aren't as different as all that. But Kit left the Bank of England because Maggie wouldn't appoint him as head of the bank, so he went to the Midland Bank and saved it from disaster. It was on the point of collapse when he took it over. The real problem I discovered was economics. I didn't study economics at Oxford, but I discovered very, very soon that economics is not a science, it's a branch of social psychology. And people try to make generalizations from situations described by their teachers when they were students, which had actually occurred 20 years earlier. So it, in a sense, economic theory tended to be based far too much on what had happened two generations earlier. And I think Keynes described economics very well when he said, in 1936 this was, "Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back." And I fear this may still be true. But that was certainly the case in my time. And what really changed everything was that Keynes had one great weakness. In his book, he shows really no sense of the importance of social organizations, especially, of course, of the trade union movement, which could decide how the money you released in taxation was spent, and how much you had to release to spend. And he had no sense in his books of the importance of world trade and the way the outside world could influence your economy. In my time, exports were just over 3% of our gross domestic product. But one day's difference in the payment for exports made a difference of £250 million in currency flows. And of course, everything got infinitely worse just as I took over because of the enormous increase in oil prices brought about by OPEC, which added £2.5 billion to our current account deficit and cut our gross domestic product, consequently, by 5%. And so I realized that it was vital to try to make ourselves less dependent on foreign oil, which meant, of course, investing money in our own oil in the North Sea. So we spent a lot of money on that. Unfortunately, we didn't gain from it, although when Maggie Thatcher took over, North Sea oil brought in an extra 5% to our gross domestic product. So that was one of the many facts which I think is often ignored by economic historians. The other great problem I've found with economics is that, and indeed with the Treasury, is that inevitably you have to rely on figures when you decide what you do, but the statistics are always unreliable. I learnt this when I was in the army because I ruptured myself on my field training course and was sent to Woolwich Barracks and then posted to replace a drunken bombardier as a railway checker on Swindon Station. And I had a job of absolutely vital importance to the war effort. I had to count the number of servicemen and women getting off every train, getting on every train, and for some reason I still don't understand, getting off and on again. Have a drink in the bar. And of course I made up the number of those getting off and on. There was no way of checking those. And I made up the number of those getting on because it was impossible on six platforms in the blackout to count them all. And I used to get the number of those getting off from the ticket collector because he collected their tickets. And after 3 weeks, I discovered he made up his numbers too. So I have always had a justified suspicion of statistics. And by God, they were justified, those suspicions, when I was Chancellor. In my first year, 74-5, the public sector borrowing requirement, that's the amount, the gap between what you were actually getting in taxes and what it cost you to spend, the estimate was £4,000 too low, which in those days was 5.4% of our gross domestic product. The next year, in 76, it was £2 billion too high. And in 77, it was in equilibrium. But of course, I had no idea it would be in equilibrium. If I'd known, I'd never have had to go to the IMF for credit, which was the most difficult decision I had in my life, and also the most difficult decision I ever had to get through cabinet. It was very, very difficult indeed, and in fact, totally unnecessary. So, I summed up my misgivings about economic forecasts in my November statement in, I think it was 1976. I said, like long-term weather forecasts, economic forecasts are better than nothing, but their origin lies in the extrapolation from a partially known past through an unknown present to an unknowable future, according to theories about the causal relationships between certain economic variables, which are hotly disputed by academic economists, and may in fact change from country to country or from decade to decade, as in fact, many of you will know, they do. So it was very, very difficult indeed. People started giving up Keynesianism because of its obvious weaknesses, and they turned instead to monetarism. Milton Friedman, who was the most important single figure, I think, in the influence of monetarism, thought that if you could control the money supply, you can control anything. But the trouble is, it is very, very difficult indeed to control the money supply. You can't do it simply through interest rates or by the amount of money you print yourself, because people nowadays get money all the time from anywhere, all over the world. And I found that even defining it was very difficult indeed. The best, I think, example of that is where are we? I've got it somewhere. Maybe I've thrown it away. Come on. Oh, yes, it was Arthur Burns, who was the American head of the Fed, the Federal Bank, chairman of the Fed, he told Congress, let me go to the month of February. We published a figure of 6.5% for the growth of money supply. It might have been using a different seasonal correction, 0%, or it might have been 10.6%. And that's not the end of the story. These figures are revised. And this is still the great problem, defining and measuring money, and why using money supply as the key to controlling the economy is a waste of time. And I always think President Johnson was right. You quoted him, Lord Desai, when Ken Galbraith went into the Oval Office when he was a great Canadian economist, a close friend of mine, who started telling Johnson what he thought about the American economy, and Johnson put his great paw on Ken's thigh and said, did you ever think, Ken, that making a speech on economics is a lot like pissing down your leg? It may seem hot to you, but it never does to no one else. And that, of course, is all too true. I think that the best judgment, I think, on economics was made by a certain Richard, the son of Nigel, not Nigel Lawson, by the way, because this was round about AD 1170, and he was Treasurer of England, at the same time Bishop of London, because God and Mammon were not quite so separate in those days as they're supposed to be these days. And he wrote in Latin, but I'll translate it, the highest skill at the exchequer does not lie in calculations, but in judgments of all kinds. And that, of course, is absolutely true. The problem is judgment, and to make good judgments, you have to be bright, but you also have to have a great deal of experience and to learn a lot from the experience of others, but also recognize that the economic situation changes from country to country, from year to year, and so the rules on which you make judgments are very, very rarely reliable. Well, there's no question. I read my wife is writing her life now, and she reads my diary, and almost every night I wrote in my diary, went to bed dog-tired. It was very, very tiring indeed, and of course became increasingly so as Infotech began to take over, and so you could be waken up at 4 in the morning by some news which had just arrived from Tokyo or Washington. And my health got worse and worse when I was Chancellor. I even got a bad attack of shingles because of my exhaustion. And in some ways, I think the British Treasury in those days was the most difficult one in the world, because it tried to deal simultaneously both with finance and with the economy. And in most of the countries which compete with us, they had separate departments dealing with money and with the economy. Secondly, we had one advantage which many countries don't have, in that my decisions, I could almost certainly rely, though it was difficult occasionally, on getting through Parliament, whereas in the United States, as you know, no president or Treasury Secretary can ever rely on getting a decision adopted by the Congress, and very often the two houses of Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, disagree, so you get what they call gridlock. So we had some advantages and some disadvantages. But I was very lucky because I had very good people working with me, Joel Barnett, who did public expenditure was quite brilliant, very hardworking, very able, and I finally managed to persuade Wilson to put him in the cabinet so that he had an independent role. Bob Sheldon was very good. I think Jack Diamond was brilliant. They were all from the north of England. Joel and Bob were both from Manchester. Jack Diamond was from Yorkshire. And the best of the lot was Edmund Dell, who is too often forgotten because very soon after being there he went to the Department of Trade and then he left politics to go and work in the city, where he really wasted the rest of his life doing nothing of much importance. The most interesting chap I had working with me was a double agent. He was Harold Lever, and he was appointed by Harold Wilson to be a spy on me in the Treasury, but I also used him to spy on Number 10. He was absolutely brilliant because he had an understanding of money, not so much the economy, which was unexampled, I think, in the country. If he ever was short of £1 million, when he left office, he used to pick up the telephone and make it in a couple of telephone calls. And he had a beautiful wife who looked rather like the French actress Jeanne Moreau, called Diane, who I'm glad to say is still around. But unfortunately, Harold died. I think the exhaustion of being a spy, both for Number 10 and Number 11, was perhaps a little too much for him. She looked like Jeanne Moreau. He looked rather like the film star Walter Matthau, whom some of you may be old enough to remember, but not perhaps very many. The most difficult period in my time, really, was the problems I had with the unions. The trade union barons were an appalling lot in my time. They never consulted their members on what they did. Very often the union policy changed 180 degrees when the union leader changed, when Terry Duffy, for example, took the place of Hugh Scanlon took the place of Terry Duffy. And the most difficult period of my life was the so-called winter of discontent, when we had several months of mass strikes all over the country, when the economy also came to a halt. We almost destroyed our motor car industry. But in the end, I developed quite good relations with them. I used to have regular meetings, spent 12 hours a week as chairman of a pay committee which include the union leaders as well as the employers and other officials from various spending departments. And in the end, I think, we made quite a go of it. And I persuaded Jack Jones and Hugh Scanlon, who were called the Terrible Twins at that time, to work quite well with me. I soon discovered, incidentally, that the tradition was always to give trade union leaders, when you met them, beer and sandwiches. But I found it was better to give them a proper meal. And I discovered before long that Hugh Scanlon's favorite dish was goujon de sol. So I always arranged that we had goujon de sol when I had them to discuss things with me at Number 11. But our pay policy, in the end, was quite successful. It cut the retail price index from the appalling level of 26.9% to 19.9% in 88, and then 4.5%, and then, unfortunately, it collapsed. I think I set the target too low. I think if it said of 5%, I'd said single figures, we'd have had settlements at about 11%, whereas in fact the settlements were raising to 24% in one, 40% in fact in the case of one trade union. One of the most important changes, I think, in British politics and economics was when we decided that, and this was John Smith and John Prescott together who did it and Maggie carried it on, was to force union leaders to consult their members before they took decisions, and we haven't really had much problem since then. In fact, I often envy Gordon Brown and Tony Blair their good luck in living in a Britain where the trade unions are not a serious problem and there's no important challenge either in policy or personality from the left wing. There's no Tony Benn or Nye Bevan as we used to have, so life is very much easier. And of course the divisions inside parties now are really deep in the Tory party rather than in the Labour Party these days. I found in the end the only way to control public spending was to set cash limits to the amount of money that was spent for each department, and oddly enough they overworked because a lot of departments actually spent a good deal less than they were given as a limit because they were terrified of going above the level set for them. Our pay policy in the end cut, as I say, the RPI from 26.9 to 19.9%, and we got unemployment and inflation down at the same time before long, which in those days was pretty well a record in Britain and indeed in most countries. And the key figure in making success of all that was a friend of mine whom I'd known since Oxford, who later became chairman of the Fabian Society, Leo Kliatsky. And one of the tragedies, I think, of British politics is that Leo died comparatively young, or I think he could have been a major influence for good on economics in our country. I did achieve one thing, however. I cut government spending on ministers' salaries, and I forced ministers to pay tax if they had lived in a government home. So oddly enough, although I was working twice as hard as Chancellor than I worked as Defence Secretary, my take-home pay was only half what I got as Defence Secretary. But that was my fault, and I don't actually regret it. The real problem I discovered before long in the British economy was not really finance or government policy. It was the inferior management in British industry. And getting that right was appallingly difficult for a government to do. We tried to influence it through the NEDI, the NEDC, National Economic Development Council, but we had only limited success. And our trade unions in those days, as I say, were very, very difficult indeed. And we were also, because we depended so much on foreign trade, exceptionally dependent on what was happening in the world economy. For example, the OPEC oil price increase added £2.5 billion to our current account deficit, a colossal amount. And then, of course, along came the information technology revolution. By 1988, 50 times more money was crossing our exchanges than the whole of our public expenditure. And the influence of information technology, our economy, was a thing we find it very, very difficult to control. Fortunately, I became chairman of the interim committee of the IMF, which was effectively the executive committee of the IMF in my last years, and I got to know most of my foreign colleagues very well, especially the Americans like Bill Simon, Ed Yeo, Arthur Burns, and in Europe, Raymond Barre in France, and Helmut Schmidt, who became my closest friend for the rest of my life, I think, in European politics, because we also had been defense secretaries before that, and a very able German minister called Manfred Lahnstein, who was simultaneously with being an economic minister a first-rate jazz player and a regular first-rate footballer, which is not so common in British politics, nor all that common, I'm bound to tell you, in German politics either. We had some very good people to work with. I liked very much Emminger, got to know him very well in Germany, and Carl Otto Perl, Jacques La Rosière in France, Vitruvian himself, who was head of the IMF itself in my time, and oddly enough was a believer in the Sufi religion, which is an Iranian religion, not quite Muslim, though some people regard it as a branch of Muslim. And one of the most interesting things was getting to know the Japanese. I found it very difficult to speaking to Japanese if we needed a translator, because it took such a long time. But the best Japanese all spoke very good English, and they were brilliant, without exception. One of the oddest men who didn't speak English was the Japanese finance minister, whose name was Fukuda, F-U-K-U-D-A, but my economic advisor, Derek Mitchell, used to describe him as Fukuda, a Welsh voluptuary, he said he is. I'm not sure that was entirely true. Well, in 1976, I needed a £5.3 billion defence standby credit. Then I got support from the IMF on condition I cut £1 billion off our public spending. But the pound then went up and up, interest rates came down to 5%, and yet I used only half of the money I was offered by the IMF, and I'd paid it all back by the time I left the Treasury. In 1978, which was my penultimate year, unemployment and prices were falling at the same time, and I was offered chairmanship of the interim committee of the IMF. And on the whole, although it was very tiring work, I did enjoy my time at the Treasury, because in the end it worked. And I managed to leave the economy in a much better state than I inherited from Tony Barber. In fact, it was regarded by the institutional investors being on the point of total collapse when I took over. I also, in the end, surprisingly, became quite a popular chancellor. And the polls showed that I'd become the most popular politician in the country. I think this was all due to my eyebrows. They've always embarrassed me slightly, and once I shaved them off for that reason, but my trousers fell down, so I had to let them go again. But it was an enjoyable time. The tragedy is that on the whole, the Treasury job was pretty successful, but of course, by that time, the nature of politics in Britain had changed enormously. Jim Callaghan said he thought there was a secular change. People had got fed up with what they called the nanny state, the welfare state, and of course Maggie Thatcher won and took over, and that's another story which I think perhaps Nigel Lawson may tell you something about. Thank you very much. I'd rather sit down there. Thank you very much.
Well, that was splendid.
Fellow. Fellow.
Hmm?
Fellow. Not a bad word.
Hmm?
Fellow. A clap out of felon.
No way. That was splendid. I was saying to Dennis Healy before we came in that when I think of the analogy of the 74-79 years, it was like going down the White Rapids in a canoe, where you had to make up your own paddle as you went along. But the amazing thing is, anybody can run the economy when things are calm and all right. Very, very difficult to run the economy when all hell is breaking loose. And Dennis Healy in those days, and I remember living through that, both as a professional economist and as a member of the Labour Party. The latter was more painful than the former. That it was just a complete miracle that we came through as well as we did. Now, I know lots of people want to ask questions, and Dennis Healy will answer the questions. Who wants to go first? Are you completely dying to ask a question? Yes, the gentleman there, yes.
Lord Healy, I'd like to ask you about the leadership contest for the Labour Party, you lost. Can you tell us what the real reasons were why you lost that? In particular, I remember hearing an explanation of Roy Hattersley, who said that there was a campaign within some MPs to deliberately not vote for you in order to weaken the Labour Party and strengthen the SDP.
Whatever that has to do with the Treasury.
Well, okay, maybe not.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, why did I lose the election for leadership? I think the basic reason was that I had to do so many unpopular things when I was Chancellor. And it's very difficult for a Chancellor to get the top job. I think it's only happened once or twice.
Which is Gordon Brown's story.
Well, it was Gordon's problem too. But, and also I wasn't terribly keen on being Prime Minister. The job I really wanted and never got was Foreign Secretary.
Absolutely.
And I would have loved to have that, but for a variety of reasons, I just wasn't available at the suitable time. I never really worked hard to be leader of the party, and there's no question that one of the reasons was that I made so many enemies in the trade union movement, and the trade unions dominated the party in those days, as I say, the barons didn't really take much note of their members. For example, when I stood for the deputy leadership, the Transport and General Workers Union, by a majority of one vote in their group at the party conference, voted for Ben rather than me, although I had a 95% majority in a poll they'd done of their own members earlier on. But that's life, isn't it?
Yeah. Gentlemen here, wait for the mic, yeah.
Thank you. Lord Healy, could you just offer a few comments on the importance of the early membership of the European community to your problems in the 70s? And if I could tie that with your thoughts on the euro and whether or not Britain should join.
Well, I've always been very, very keen on Britain working with the Europeans, and when I was Defence Secretary, for example, I set up the European Planning Group inside NATO. But I've never been in favour of European Federation, which was the stated objective of the people like Jean Monnet, who started the European movement. In practice, of course, support for federation in Europe is limited to the very small countries like Holland and Luxembourg. The French would never support being members of a federation, nor in practice would the Germans, although they've often talked in favour of it. The problem to me of the euro and the European Monetary Union is that you can't have a single currency without having a single fiscal policy. And you can't have a single fiscal policy without having at least a federal government. I'm not in favour of that. And I think even now we find that the EMU is not working well, or the European Monetary Union is not working well, or the euro inside Europe itself. The Germans practically now have turned completely against it. The French have always really been against it. And so I think, in fact, Gordon Brown's arguments against it, totally justified, or let me say his conditions for joining, which are conditions we all know will never be met. But I think we are finding as time passes that the issue now, I think, is going to sink into the sand.
Gentlemen here, yeah.
Thank you, Lord Healy. It's said often of Chancellor Brown that he controls a lot of the domestic agenda by virtue of the money that is allocated as between departments. Was it possible for you to influence domestic policy to the same extent in your day? And just as an aside, the story about you turning around at the airport to go back to the Labour Party conference, could you just tell us how apocryphal that was? Thank you.
Well, there are two quite different questions. The first is the amount of spending allocated to departments. Well, that is decided by the Cabinet as a whole, but of course the Chancellor has an enormous influence on it, and I did in fact have a great deal of influence on it in my time, but not, of course, total control. I mean, Barbara really, in the end, left the Cabinet was sacked because she wouldn't go along with my policy. Barbara Castle wouldn't go along with my policy. The other question was...
Turning back at the airport.
The what? Oh, why did I turn back? Oh, well, that's a very easy one. it was the value of sterling. I was due to go to a meeting of, I think, the Commonwealth economic ministers in the Philippines, and when I got to the aircraft, I listened to the radio, and the pound was falling very, very rapidly as I listened to the radio on the way to the airport. And then when I got there into the private lounge, to which possibly VIP lounge it was called, very important persons, VIP stands for, I decided it was a terrible error, would be a terrible mistake to be away. Jim had advised me to go to the meeting, but I decided I couldn't afford to be away, especially as the party conference was taking place in Scarborough. So I decided when I got to the airport with my wife that I wouldn't go. And then I had to book an aircraft, private aircraft, to take me from Northolt to the nearest airport to Scarborough so that I could get to the conference. And then I had to defend my policy from the floor because I wasn't a member of the National Executive in 5 minutes. And when I went to the platform, the whole of the enormous auditorium was booming with boos. When I sat down, saying that I was going to stick to all my decisions, including the unpopular ones, I had almost as many cheers as boos. But it was one of my most difficult times.
I recommend the TV file on that. George Jones, Professor George Jones.
Lord Healy, do you think, in retrospect, that Harold Wilson's creation of the policy unit was a useful addition and helpful to good government?
Sorry, his creation of what?
The policy.
The policy unit headed by Lord Donoghue.
Oh, yes.
Do you think, in retrospect, that it helped good government?
I can't see really that it did. In principle, I wouldn't be against it, but the real trouble with Harold is that he wouldn't set up anybody unless he knew he controlled a majority of its members. He was quite unlike Jim Callaghan, who was prepared to take a decision against the will of the whole of the Cabinet or Economic Committee, which he'd been chairing. For that reason, and I mean, Harold would appoint people to the Cabinet just because he knew they would do what he wanted, like Lord Chalfont and who was a woman at that time?
Shirley Williams.
What?
Not Shirley Williams.
I've forgotten her name. But Wilson, in fact, was an awful Prime Minister. He's rather like Harold Macmillan, very like Harold Macmillan. They were both opportunists with no real sense of values and no principles, so there's nothing to guide them except, what would get them through the next problem. Very similar they were, the two of them.
Okay, let me go to that side, yeah.
Lord Healy, I was very interested in your reference to creative tension between yourself and Gordon Richardson. And I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the advantages of creative tension, bearing in mind that the establishment of the Department of Economic Affairs in 1964 didn't seem to do very much positive as a result of the creative tension between the Treasury and the DEA. And also, perhaps you could tell us, which is really a rather separate question, whether you felt creative tension when Jim Callaghan told the cabinet in the autumn of 1978 that he wouldn't go to the country.
Well, I think between Gordon and me, the creative tension was a very good thing because we both liked and respected one another's views. Gordon, of course, had one prime responsibility which took precedence over everything else, which was the value of sterling. I was concerned with employment, equality of opportunity, all sorts of other things. So the tension between us was genuinely creative. I think you couldn't say that really of tension between bodies, because bodies tend, well, departments, they represent different departments which have different interests, and so that the tension there is not creative in the same sense at all. But Gordon, as I say, was a very intelligent man with a lot of understanding. He'd been a very successful banker in the merchant bank, Schroeder Wagg, for 10 years, in fact, before he went to the Bank of England. And I think the relationship between the two of us was good for the economy. And as I say, we remain good friends and still are now. I go and see him whenever I get near to his home in Gloucestershire.
Okay. Yeah, gentleman there.
Thanks very much. Yes, Lord Healy, it's a question which has two questions bound up in it. I was listening to you the other evening in a radio interview, which was really amusing, where you described Gordon Brown as being perhaps the greatest chancellor we've had, and certainly greater than yourself. And I didn't know quite how to take that, and I discussed it with a friend of mine the following day, who's a great admirer of yourself, such as I am. And I said, did you hear this? And he said, no. And I said, well, Healy's actually saying that Gordon Brown is a greater chancellor than himself, and I don't really understand that. And I went through a series of what I regard to be policy failures of Gordon Brown. He's made a few policy successes as well. But the first one I mentioned, I won't go through them all here because we haven't got time, was the refusal to consider the renationalisation of the railways. And my friend said, ah, but haven't you heard, Healy would agree with that, because he now says that the Labour government's policy in respect of the nationalised industries was incorrect. So there's two questions there. One, should the Labour government have renationalised, the Blair government, renationalised the railways on coming to power? And two, were the Labour government's policies in the 1960s and 1970s mistaken in respect of not privatising the utilities earlier than they were under Maggie?
Well, I personally think that it would have been sensible to renationalise the railways, because I think that to have completely separate bodies in different areas is not sensible. I found that very much when I had to go to Telford recently last week to talk, and found. And secondly, the railways are bloody awful now. I mean, when I the train was late arriving in Birmingham from Euston, and I had to sit there for 40 minutes till the next train arrived. And during that time, loudspeaker in the station was announcing almost every bloody train was late, wherever it was coming from, and one of them was 12 hours late. So I think they're in an awful mess now, and I think perhaps renationalisation would be helpful. On the other question, which was
whether in the 1964-70 and 74-79 Labour governments, you should have privatised the utilities before Maggie got under the
I think it would have made sense to privatise some of them, but frankly, I don't remember enough now to know which ones I would say. I'm not against privatization in principle at all, and I think that privatization of the railways has been a total disaster. I don't think that's quite the same with, for example, electricity and several other areas.
Okay, gentlemen there. Sorry, lady there first, yeah. Because no woman has yet asked a question, so I've got it.
Margaret Thomas, graduate of the school, and one who has George Brown's National Plan still on her shelf. What I wonder is, can we ever get away from short-termism? In other words, this annual budget that we have emanating from the Treasury. Do you think there can be a longer planning horizon, particularly in what is increasingly becoming a global economy?
I didn't catch the
long-term plan.
What? Oh, no, I don't. I think an annual budget is quite sensible because the situation, both domestically and abroad, can change very, very fast. As the most obvious example is the oil crisis and the possibility, you know, the war of Iraq, stopping the supply of oil from the Middle East, that sort of thing. I think to try to plan further ahead than a year is a mistake. But it doesn't mean that every year you have to change everything. I mean, if things are going well, you obviously don't want to change them. Incidentally, I didn't comment on George Brown. I think George has been It was Gordon Brown, was it? What?
It was Gordon Brown.
It was Gordon. No, I mean, I think Gordon has been a first-rate Chancellor, and our economy is doing better than any other economy in Europe at the present time. And one of the most important things he's doing is stop Tony Blair rushing into the European monetary system, the euro. Of course he's made some mistakes, but everybody makes some mistakes, but I think he's been a very good Chancellor. But again, as I think I said in my opening talk, he and Tony Blair have been incredibly fortunate compared with all their predecessors in that they've had no serious problems with the trade union movement and no serious challenge in policy or personality from the left. I mean, the nearest thing they've got to the left is Peter Hain.
Gentlemen there, yeah.
Lord Healy, following on from your comments on Gordon Brown, soon after New Labour came to power in 1997, of course, he took this important decision of handing over the setting of interest rates to the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England. How much would you say that the country's relative economic success since then has been due to that one far-sighted decision?
Well, I think it was a sensible decision, but to say how much it's been responsible for, I mean, the real important thing with Gordon Brown is his prudence in tax and spending. That's the key, much more important than the independence of the bank.
Indeed. What's next? Yes, okay, gentleman there.
There's a very wicked man there.
Oh, hey, well, if he was to, as much as raise his hand, I'd love him to ask a question.
No, come on, there's a young man over there.
Yeah, young man over there, before the young man over
young
there.
Young man, thank you. Thank you very much. I forgot what I was going to say now. During your time in the Treasury, you were very complimentary about many of your officials, but you found some of them to be actively disloyal and conspiring against you, didn't you? conspiring with the Americans to force monetarism onto this country. Is that correct? And how difficult was that to deal with?
I mean, I obviously disagreed with some of my officials, and the basic thing with both the jobs I've had, Treasury and the bank, I don't like taking a decision on the advice of the Permanent Secretary alone. I like to get a meeting with all the relevant people from the department, including junior people, not just heads of a section, and let them argue things out in front of me, with me taking part as well. And I think if you do it that way, it works very well, and it certainly did with me.
Sam, hang on, mic is coming down.
I was wondering whether to ask a question or not, but I have two rather different questions. One is an institutional one. You said that combining finance and economics was not a very good idea, and certainly there is a case for there being an additional economics ministry, but how would you do it? I think you said the DA didn't work very well. In France and Germany, they have now combined economics and finance. You're also not too impressed by the Prime Minister's policy unit. How actually would you set up this countervailing pole? The other question, slightly more technical, is do you think that your advisers panicked too much about sterling and perhaps did not realize sufficiently that we were on a floating rate which was bound to move up and down, and now that the 30-year rule is over and we're getting all the papers, we get so many of these ridiculous emergency plans they had for siege economy. One, the worst one was called Operation Brutus. Yes. Which you might have inherited, and perhaps you wouldn't even have had to turn around at London Airport, even on the basis of bad figures, if you thought of sterling as a price which goes up and down.
Well, the first question really was, remind me quickly.
How you would have a different kind of economics ministry.
Oh, well, I personally much prefer the British system in which finance and the economy are under the same department, because if they're different departments, you can get not a creative tension, but a destructive tension between the two. I think you've got enough difference if you have an independent central bank. You don't need to have an independent finance department as well. The other question was, remind me,
exchange rate.
Oh yes, the strength of sterling. I think that was a great mistake, that we were too worried about sterling. I think the real trouble was we had too much permanent devotion to the old systems in the financial area, and I think that we should have been prepared. The opposition to ending the sterling area, for example, which was an extraordinary anomaly and had lost really its ability to work once the Commonwealth countries became genuinely independent, was a great mistake. And we worried a great deal too much about our currency. And I think that's an area where it does make sense to allow the markets to have a big influence, providing the markets are regulated.
The one there.
Lord Healy, I have a question about American policy making. Why is it in America the Federal Reserve is seen as the prime mover of the economic policy? For example, Arthur Burns, Paul Volcker, Alan Greenspan. What they say and what they do is more important than what the finance ministry is actually doing. So much so that when President Bush became president, the first person he met was Alan Greenspan. Why is it so important there? The Federal Reserve is seen as more important than, say, finance minister.
Well, America is an enormous continent and requires a federal state because the differences in interest actually between different areas, like between the South, the West, the East, Middle West, so that system makes sense. They have a single currency, so they need, of course, a single central bank, which is the Federal Reserve. And on the whole, I think, when they've had good heads of the Fed, like particularly the one I knew best was Paul Volcker, I think it's worked very, very well indeed. I think at the moment I don't know enough in detail, and you have to know these things in more detail than you get, and the only paper frankly worth reading in this area is the Financial Times. The others, the people don't seem to understand very much what's going on. I think that Bush is taking a lot of silly decisions. I think his decision to have these big tax cuts without making it clear what spending is going to be cut at the same time is a very dangerous one. I don't know enough about what Kerry is doing. I read, as I say, the only paper I find worth reading in this area is the FT. And I think people are still very uncertain how much his economic policy will vary from Bush's when he takes over. What I found was very useful in my time was what was called the Council of Economic Advisers, of which Alan Greenspan in my time was the head. He later became, of course, much more important. And I think you need a different system for a country that size from what we have here. But nobody seems to be very clear about what Kerry's real policies are in this area. And perhaps he's rather wise. Perhaps he hasn't a clue yet what they should be. He's not actually had a federal office before. And running the American Federation is so totally different from being a senator in a single state. One of the great advantages we have in this country compared with the Americans is that in our country, people in opposition know that if they're leaders, they're going to have jobs if they win the election. So they think very hard about what to do, and they're very cautious about committing themselves to do things unless they're fairly satisfied that if they win, they can actually do them. This constraint doesn't apply at all in the United States, and people can make the most ludicrous promises. I think Kerry is being sensibly very cautious about it. But for that reason, I'm afraid, it's very difficult for anybody outside, and businesses finding this difficulty. And I'm quite interested, I think, was it yesterday or today, the FT had a list of the way the big businesses in the United States were lining up behind one and the other. And it was very difficult, actually, to say that one had a more important set of business supporters than the other. Didn't you think so, Sam? No, I agree with you, but this was very much the case. And that means, I think, that Kerry will follow a sensible policy, but I think he won't make tax cuts unless he knows where he's going to cut the spending to go with it. And that seems very uncertain in the United States. I mean, at the moment, they're planning to spend more and more in Iraq on defense. And they've no exit strategy from Iraq, so that you may find that the cost of the Iraq war increases steadily as the election approaches. And then Kerry has to decide whether or not he's going to support it. At the moment, he's still supporting it. But I think, of course, it's been a total disaster for America, for the Iraqis, and for the world.
This is not strictly about finance, but how could, if you were his foreign policy advisor,
to Kerry,
how could he get out?
The question is, if Dennis Healy was Kerry's...
If I were advising Kerry, how would I tell him he could get out of the war in Iraq? Well, the obvious thing is start negotiating with the United Nations and see if they will agree to have a protectorate in Iraq which will allow the Americans to withdraw. That, I think, is the only way of getting out now. And I think it could come to that, very likely, although it would be an awful burden on the UN, of course. But the American policy there is an absolute disaster because it's got the whole of Iraq now turned against the United States. But the civil war will follow between the Sunni Shia and the Kurds. And on top of that, you've got a big increase in terrorism, and everybody who knows the area has been predicting this.
But they wouldn't have done it without Blair. Pardon? And Brown. They wouldn't have done it without Blair, would they?
They wouldn't what?
They wouldn't the have American done it without...
The Americans wouldn't have invaded Iraq without Blair.
I don't know, but I think Blair has made several serious mistakes in his last term. The most serious, by far, was supporting Bush in Iraq. But equally, I think he's made inexcusably mistakes on financial hospitals and university entrance fees. He's really got ready like Maggie, like Eden on Iraq, and like Maggie on poll tax and these domestic issues.
My Dennis Healy.
I've expressed it in public, so I should say it's a personal view, but not a private one.
Dennis Healy has to go at 8 o'clock. It's 7:46. I'm going to take one more question, and that's from above. And make it short, and don't give a speech.
Very simple. Lord Healy, if James Callaghan had gone to the country in 1978...
If what?
If James Callaghan had gone to the country in 1978,
yes.
Would you have won that election?
I think, personally, that if he'd gone as soon as... you know, immediately, instead of hanging on for an extra 2 years. and he said he did it to take the shine off the ball for me, and of course he ripped the leather off the ball, no, not just the shine. I think that we might have won the election, but we certainly would have, because I would have taken over from him, she would only have had one term rather than 13 years. But I think the trouble with oppositions is that they tend often to go for the person who's to their ideological extreme. And if the Tories have any sense now, they go for Ken Clark rather than Howard. Because there's no chance of winning under Howard. Under Ken Clark, I think it would be a serious threat to Labour. But even Portillo, I think, under him. And I think that and we made, in my view, although I was his deputy, we made a great mistake in choosing Michael Cook. If Jim had gone earlier, I would have won. Most people agree about that, and we wouldn't have had the split of the, you know, the Lib Dems, which took 27 Labour MPs out of the House, in fact, because they lost the election, the next election. And I don't think we'd have had these years of Maggie. Still, many of you would probably feel that would have been a bad thing.
Well, thank you very much. I think Dennis Healy has been very generous with his time and answered lots of questions. Thank you very much for that. He told me before we came in that he was 84 years old. But as you know, with numbers, they're not reliable. I think
thank you very much.